It's time. It's time to open your eyes. It's time to open your mind. It's time to grow up and face reality. It's time to lock and load because it's Meat Trapper time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 144 of Meat Trapper Radio. Now, on tonight's episode, we're going to talk about two things. We're going to pick up where we left off last week with a submission from Brandon, who recently went through the catastrophic flooding in Nebraska and who's sharing his thoughts and tips while they're still fresh in his mind off of his experience. And then we're also going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about non-lethal self-defense because, you know, we're all macho guys and, you know, we're all packing heat and all of that kind of stuff. But in today's society, no matter how badly they need it, you can't just pull your gun out and start shooting people because they got it coming, unfortunately. And I say that because it's just been one of those days today. Do you ever have those days where you just feel like everybody on the planet is a damn dumbass? And that if you want anything done right, you got to do it yourself. It was just one of those days. There was a lot going on at work today. And it's funny how do you ever get the feeling that it just always comes down to you, that everything gets passed down and passed down and passed down to where it all ends up on you because everybody else is either lazy, stupid, will screw it up, or they just don't give a crap. And it ends up, the burden ends up falling on those of us who aren't lazy, who aren't stupid, and who do care. And you just get to the point sometimes where you feel like you're at the breaking point. And it's funny how people will just toss it on you and not think twice about it, you know. It's almost like they know there's something deep within inside us that we can't just turn our back on things. We can't just shirk things. And, you know, an example was Brian McKee of SouthernSnares.com, who's the sponsor of this show and the reason this show stays on the air. And I encourage all of you to support Brian because Brian sticks his neck out and he supports all of you. Okay. But he and I are collaborating on a survival snaring DVD. This is something we've been kicking around for a while and we're getting down to brass tacks and I'll have more on that later. But we ordered a product and it was a product that was comprised of two components and the box showed up today and only half the product was in there. And you're like, really? How hard is this? It just never ceases to amaze me. And then at the same time, I have another shipment of Wild Man poaching manuals on the way. And I've mentioned before, these books are self-published, so Wild Man has to have them published and printed at his own expense. And then I purchase them from him, and I put about $5 on each book to cover my time and all of that. And I resell the book. And I don't mind telling you what I make on it. I don't make hardly anything when you consider all the time, trouble, and headaches and all of that. And the taxes that I have to pay, I make very, very little on it. But the reason that I offer the book for sale is because it's a great book, it's entertaining, it's educational, and we have to get this kind of information into as many people's hands as possible. You know, that's the thing. This is a service. And I don't say that because he's a great guy or I'm a great guy or anything like this, because, you know, we every man deserves to be compensated for his time. But it's a money-losing proposition for me when you get down to how much time it takes. But, you know, when the books get shipped, I get a tracking number. So you can see, you know, has where is it at? And it's just amazing. This package has sat in the post office of origin for going on 4 days now. You know, it's incredible. It really is. And this is just a harbinger of things to come. It's a sign of things to come, to where the normal functioning of society starts to break down. And things that should be taken for granted now consume an inordinate amount of your time, such as being able to mail a package and get it in a reasonable amount of time, or purchasing something and actually getting what you purchase. Because let me share an alternative example here. There's a company, and this is the advantage of doing business with a person, with a locally owned company, with a privately owned company instead of a corporate conglomerate. My absolute favorite outdoor clothing company is firstlight.com. I own a lot of their clothes. If I'm a fanboy of anything, I'm a fanboy of First Light clothing. They recently sent me an email that they had a new version of their pants available, a hot weather version of their corrugate pants. And these are expensive pants. They're $150 a pair. I ordered one immediately. As soon as the email came in, clicked order it. A few days goes by, nothing shows up. I get a phone call. Okay. And it's the man from First Light. He called me because he's calling every person that ordered those pants. And he said, once we got into this and we got our shipment in, we realized these pants were not up to spec. They didn't meet our quality control standards. So I'm not going to sell them. So I'm going to refund your money in its entirety, and I'm sending you a coupon for 25% off your next order. And, you know, that means a lot. That means a lot, because you don't get that kind of treatment hardly anywhere. And what he did was, I was already a loyal customer. Now I'm a fanatical customer. And that's what I try and do with my knives, with the Meat Trapper Skinner. What's really interesting about that knife is people that order one, they not only do they email me telling me how much they love the knife and how impressed they are with the knife and how well it fits their hand and how sharp it is and what a magnificent job it does slicing and cutting meat, they usually order one or more extras, and they give them as gifts. They buy them for their friends. And that means a lot to me, because when a man orders a $250 knife and then he turns right around and he orders two or three or four more, that tells you something. So anyway, enough droning on about the sad state of affairs. So let's go ahead and get started with tonight's show. And like I said, we're going to pick up where we left off last week with Brandon from Nebraska. And if you missed that episode, you might want to go back and listen to it. But Nebraska has been just obliterated with flooding and terrible weather. And it's had catastrophic damage. And so Brandon is sharing his thoughts on short-term prepping while they're still fresh on his mind. And he's going to pick up now with generators and electricity. And I may chime in from time to time and offer my two cents on his comments as well. So take it away, Brandon.
Okay. So moving on, that's the next topic is electricity. Get a generator. Get a battery bank backup. Solar panel, something. I would definitely, for the short term, I would definitely look at a generator. It's going to burn gas, yes. Is it going to make noise? Yes. But it's going to be instant power, rain or shine, whatever you need. Get a generator and use it. Do you need a generator that's going to power your whole house? Do you need one of them whole house generators hooked up, you know, to the plug-in that automatically kicks on when the power goes out? No, you don't need that. That's going to cost a whole lot of money. You could do that. I mean, that's a great way to be prepared. I mean, you're definitely, if you can sit there with the air conditioning on or the heater on and stay high and dry and good to go, by all means do it if that's what you want to do. But a small generator that can run a fridge, a freezer, charge batteries, power radios, power sump pumps, and maybe some small essential items that are in your house that you can run a power cord to and charge and run power to. That's what you want as an essential item, especially in a short-term situation. And another thing is that make sure that you maintain that generator. You know, keep stable in the fuel. Cycle and run it once a month. Keep enough fuel on hand to run it for a month or two if you need to. Keep it serviced, keep it running, test it, load test it. You know, that's all part of being prepared. Last thing you want to do is run outside and have to, you know, use it and go to start it and it doesn't run because the carburetor's all gummed up because you never treated the fuel or ran the thing.
Now let me just interrupt here because I want to add to this. He's exactly right. What Brandon's telling you here is exactly right. Now when it comes to generators, my generator of choice is the Honda EU series. And the EU series is an inverter type generator. And you need to understand that different generators are going to output different qualities of electricity. And what I mean by that is the Honda EU series, the inverter generators, will put out sine wave, perfect sine wave electricity. Cheap department store type generators that are just designed to work at a construction site and run power saws and what have you are not going to put out sine wave quality electricity. The difference is that sensitive appliances such as computers, even today's refrigerator freezers that have control boards in them, circuit boards to control everything, they're very sensitive to variations in electricity. And if you go out and buy a cheap generator and then run it for 2 or 3 days during a power outage and you're using it to power your sensitive appliances, you can end up ruining your appliances because you used a cheap generator. Now, like I say, if you're just running a circular saw, there's nothing sensitive about that. But if you're running a laptop computer or ham radio, different story entirely. When it comes to the noise, this is a huge issue when it comes to people tracking you down and stealing your generator. Remember, when the power is out, everything is going to be dark except for you, because you've got lights. Plus, that generator is loud. It can be heard for a long, long way because there's not going to be nearly as much ambient noise or traffic noise or what have you. Once again, the Honda EU series is extremely quiet, and with their eco throttle, the generator will throttle up or down depending upon the load that's placed on it. And this goes to the surge capacity of a generator, because there are a lot of appliances, such as a freezer, refrigerator, or things like that, that have a motor, have a compressor, and it takes a lot of power to start that motor. And then once the motor is started or the compressor is started, then the power requirement drops off significantly. The Honda generators are smart enough to know that when that appliance kicks on, it'll rev up the power output of the generator, and then you can hear it idle back down as it goes into a steady state of power production. This economizes fuel, and also it greatly reduces the noise. These Honda generators are so quiet that you can stand right beside one and talk in a normal voice and have a normal conversation. So to me, that's a big, big deal. You can look on the internet and you can find plans on how to muffle generators, how to locate them, and still provide ventilation and muffle the noise down. That's a big deal. The fuel that I use, I only buy 97 octane. I buy the highest quality fuel, and the stabilizer that I use is PRI-G, P-R-I space G. I like it better than Stable. It's used to stabilize fuel in very, very expensive yachts. But anyway, the idea is to stabilize the fuel. Secondly, when it comes to storing fuel, I refuse to store fuel in a plastic can. I have military-grade jerry cans, and they're worth their weight in gold. You know, the federal government is busy trying to eliminate anything that's not CARB-compliant, California Air Board, whatever the crap it is. They can take all of that and stick it where the sun doesn't shine. I'm going to have my military jerry cans. I rotate the fuel, because fuel mixtures in this country vary between winter and summer. They have different crap in them. And Brandon is exactly right when it comes to maintaining your generator. It's not enough to simply run the generator dry or drain the fuel or what have you. I did that with my Honda 1 year, and then when I came back to later to start it, it wouldn't start. The carburetor was gummed up, and that's because there was gasoline left in the float bowl. In the bowl of the carburetor. And with all of the crap they put in gas these days, that isn't going to work. So if you're going to store it for an extended period of time and not run it, you need to actually take the bowl off the carburetor and drain it. Otherwise, on a sensitive unit like a Honda, you're asking for trouble. Okay? And different areas of the country have different levels of additives in the gasoline. I just moved to a new town from Birmingham, Alabama, and I had my Honda lawnmower stored over the winter here, and when I took that carburetor apart with the gas that I'd purchased here, I was stunned at what was on the inside of that carburetor. It looked like jelly, like petroleum Vaseline, petroleum jelly. I had never seen anything like that in my life, because I'd lived in a different area most of my adult life. So you have to maintain that. The last thing that I want to mention before we get back to Brandon is, if you're going to run a generator off extension cords, once again, if you've got an expensive freezer, an expensive refrigerator, an expensive computer, don't skimp on extension cords. Go out and buy a high quality, thick 10 gauge extension cord. Don't go buy the cheapest orange outdoor extension cord from Walmart, because you need a large diameter wire. Make sure it's a quality extension cord, and it's got plenty of capacity to carry the juice. I refuse to use cheap extension cords. So anyway, I'll try not to interrupt, but let's get back to Brandon.
Water is super essential. You can't go more than a few days without it, and then you die. So you got to have it. It's having water storage is a really, really good idea. Bottles of water, using a bib bag, having water on hand, ready to go right then and there is a really good practice. Are you going to have, 5,000 gallons of water stored, you know, for, you know, years at a time. No, you don't, that's not the plan. Plan is the short term, to have enough water to get you through a short term situation. But then you also need to be thinking about a little bit of long term, or in case that water storage is no good and you have to move on to plan B. So I would suggest that you guys go out, spend $25 on Amazon, I believe is what they are, and get you a Sawyer water filter. Very, very cheap filter. Does a really, really good job and can filter thousands of gallons and can be cleaned out. It's one of the few filters that can actually do that. They use a dialysis filter, and they get the 99.999% of the microbials and all that kind of stuff. Definitely could be a lifesaver, and they're very small. You know, it could fit in your pocket. So get you one of those, get you a couple of them, have them available in your bug out bags or whatever you're going to do. Okay, next topic is going to be communication, short term. You know, during this disaster, we had communication. We had cell phones. Most everything was up for the most part. We actually did have some areas that did fail internet-wise. They didn't have internet, but they still had the cell phone. Cell phone service was working. The towers were all still going. And I know in a lot of situations, grid down situations like hurricanes or even tornadoes for that matter, cell phones go down. Look at 9/11. On 9/11, there were cell phones that went down, cell phone towers and service and all that stuff. There's a lot of pandemonium when people can't get on their phones and communicate with each other. They don't know where each other are. So how do we prevent that? There's a lot of different things you can do. Obviously, just having an AM/FM radio with a battery backup, great way of getting information. Have one. They're cheap. They don't cost hardly anything. You can keep them stored in your basement or in a bag or in your vehicle, whatever. And you'll always have the ability to catch up on what's going on. Second would be to have a scanner to listen to police bands, radio, different things like that to see what emergency services are doing and what they're up to. Kind of give you a little idea of what you need to do, where you need to go, how you need to prepare. And then next, I would say, would be two-way radios for communication with your family, friends, you know, people in your tribe, people in your group. A lot of these guys are using two-way radios, and that kind of leads into ham radio, which is a fantastic way to communicate during crisis and emergency situations, because these ham operator or ham radio repeater stations are all over the place, and most of them are battery backed up and solar powered, and they're even in rural areas. So it will give you the ability to communicate with people and at least stay up on the news and see what's going on. So keep that in mind. Have a plan to communicate if the grid goes down, because Verizon is not always going to be there in certain situations. So be aware of that.
And at this point, we're going to take a break, and we'll pick up with the part three, the final part of Brandon's submission, on the next episode, because there's still more to come. Now, to shift gears a little bit, we're going to talk about non-lethal self-defense. Now, I know this runs contrary to most of our way of thinking, because let's face it, we're all sick of the crap that goes on in this country day in and day out. We're sick of the namby-pamby court system that ends up putting the wrong person under the gun. But we have to face reality that we live in a nation now where you can't always do the right thing. You can't always give somebody what they deserve or what they've got coming. Especially with the racially, ethnically, and socially charged undertones of the justice system. And all you have to do, if you want to see examples of what I'm talking about, is just get on YouTube and look at some of the situations that people encounter on a daily basis. And if you live in a rural area, you probably don't encounter this, but if you live in an urban area, you encounter it on a regular basis. And that is, you encounter situations where lethal force may not be justified, but you're then faced with either taking it or being bullied or being a victim of some sort or using lethal force. You know, in other words, if your only weapon is a firearm, you either use it or you don't. And this is why law enforcement has long understood this. And that's why they have a continuum of force. They have a variety of applications of force at their disposal. That's why they have, you know, pepper spray, they have tasers, you know, different things like that, to where they, you know, they can't just pull out a pistol and kill somebody. But then again, they, you know, can't get involved in a fist fight one-on-one. So there's that gray area in between. And, you know, this covers not only interpersonal relationships, but encounters with animals, as Joe's going to explain. Just a lot of situations that you need to have something in the middle. You need to have an option other than putting up with it or killing somebody. Because let's just be honest, in most of the United States, or what's left of it, if you pull a firearm out, you're going downtown. Even if it's justified. And that's not even using it. That's just producing the firearm. And you should never produce a firearm unless you're prepared to use it. And if you do use a firearm, your life just got turned upside down. All you have to do is get on YouTube, get on the internet, and look this stuff up. You shoot somebody, if you have any resources whatsoever, they're coming after you. You're going downtown. You're going to be guilty until proven innocent. You're going to retain an attorney. You're going to have tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees. You're probably going to be sued by the perpetrator's relatives. Even if you're completely 100% justified, they can still file a lawsuit against you. I mean, you can sue anybody. You can sue somebody because you don't like the way they look. And, you know, this is called lawfare. And people do this all the time because these shyster lawyers will do it so that you can settle out of court, because they figured out how much it's going to cost you to defend yourself and clear your name. And if you can settle for half of that and they get a cut, then they all win and you lose a little less than you would have. And after Joe talks about his options, I'm going to present a couple of other options, specifically one option that I'm enamored with. So anyway, let's take a listen to Joe and see what he has to say.
Hey, meat trapper. It's Joe, and I got a subject matter that I'd love to get your input on, or at least expose your listeners to, because I think it can do a lot of people a lot of good. And it's something that's been a part of my life for a long time, and it's kept me from many bad situations. And that is what I'm referring to as the self-defense method of pepper spray. And I think it's very much a undervalued and overlooked and not really discussed self-defense item, but it has a hell of a lot of advantages and pros. And it has a lot of unique advantages that other things can't do or don't compare. So anyway, in my mind, here are some of the pros that I wish more people took into consideration or were exposed to, and put them into application, you know, because this could easily save your life, as it has done for my own. So I think going down some of the pros is that pepper spray is pretty much allowed everywhere, so there's really no reason for you to not have it on you. You know, you can carry it in churches, banks, universities, you know, fill in the blank. Anywhere that's generally restricted when it comes to pepper spray is not. Something that goes along with that, I think, is because pepper spray has, it's almost an ingrained victim mentality perception if you deploy it or if you use it. It's, for whatever reason, you know, if you pepper sprayed somebody, they almost automatically think that you are the victim of something. So I think that in itself is a big merit to get have that common perception that some other items don't carry. And then on top of that, with pepper spray, it's a dual-purpose self-defense item. It's good for both people and animals. And when I mean animals, what I have experience with using it on is dogs. I've run into a lot of aggressive dogs in my life, and I've been glad I've had pepper spray numerous times. So, you know, it's also a dual-purpose type item. And coming back to that with threats, whether they be animal or people, pepper spray allows you to keep that threat at a distance that a lot of other weapons, besides firearms, really don't allow you to do much. And for whatever reason, it seems popular that everybody wants to, it's almost like they want to bring their threats to arm's length of them. You know, as you've seen the popularity of crenulated bezel, you know, striking implement flashlights and Kubatons and tactical pens, which I think is absurd. You know, if you've got a threat within arm's reach of you and you have to use an item like that, you've already lost control of that situation. I want my threats at a distance. All you're doing by bringing a threat close to you or relying on something like that is increasing your chances of getting hurt, whether it's a person or an animal. You know, I like to keep things away from me. That seems to be the best way to get out of a confrontation or a problem. Is if you can put some distance between yourself and a threat, that's the way to go. And then going back to the, because you can deter with it rather than permanently stop, which in itself is a pro, you can avoid court, you know, which in itself is a huge advantage. You know, I don't think there's anything unmanly about trying to avoid court or court fees or the law or any part of that, you know, because even if it's a justifiable self-defense and you deploy a firearm, you basically open Pandora's box as to the ramifications that can come your way. Even if it was, you know, black and white, we all know about those cases, and I know you've read about that kind of stuff. It's not clear cut, you know. And if you can avoid all that and deter something rather than permanently stop it, you know, I think that's a major plus. And that isn't to say if you conceal carry holder, I myself am. But I think it's important to have layers of defense and to be able to escalate up to something should it be needed. Now, if a threat warrants, you know, a firearm, that's one thing, you're going to recognize that. But there's a lot of threats that don't warrant a firearm, but you still want to put distance between yourself and it, or you want it to get it away from you. When I think about that, I think about road rage incidences. I'm not going to have somebody beating on the windshield, not happening. You know, or beating on the side of the car, or trying to pull you out of your car, which is very common today in America, and I've actually seen that in person. So, you know, I think of road rage, I think of belligerent drunks, I think of panhandlers or beggars, you know, and those people can come running up on you in gas stations or parking lots. You know, you don't want them up on you. I don't want those people anywhere near me, you know. So if I can put some distance between myself and them in a non-lethal manner, you know, I'm going to go that route every time. So, and then, of course, there's also, if you want to get more off the grid, off the wall type use for it, you can also use it as a deterrent if you were being pursued or if you had somebody in an area that you didn't want them to be. You can spray it in the air and create a hazardous atmosphere. You can do an air suspension of it, and it stays in the air for a very long time. It takes a long time for that stuff to settle out of the air. So if you had somebody beating on your door, you know, you could spray it in front of your door. If you were trying to prevent somebody from following you, or you had a group following you, you could spray it in hallways. It's nasty stuff, and it takes a long time for it to get out of the air. So actually, in a lot of jail and prison atmospheres, and your LEOs listening will know this, they'll do a lot of cell extractions with pepper spray, some of which they're not even spraying whoever's in the cell. Just the fact that it's aerosol and it's in the air will cause people to become compliant and leave their cell. So that's more of a kind of off-the-wall use for it, but you can use it very much similar to almost like tear gas, where they'll put that in the air. It has very similar deterrent effects. So something else to think about. And going back to the dual purpose with both people and dogs, I've had numerous encounters with aggressive dogs throughout my life. And pepper spray, I've used it many times, and it's always been very effective. Dogs hate it. They don't want. They have very sensitive noses. They don't want anything being sprayed in their eyes and nose. And actually, it's interesting. I've had dogs chase me before and come running up to me before in an aggressive manner. And even me presenting that pepper spray towards them before I even spray it, they don't like it. They see it as threatening. They don't know who I am, what I'm about, or what I have in my hand. They don't like it. So actually, they usually start backing up. I've had this happen in person. They'll back up just with me extending my arm towards them with that pepper spray canister in my hand. So it's interesting. Because I've had some bad dog experiences. I've been chased up on cars by pit bulls. I've had dogs chasing me. I've had dogs circling me. I've had hunting dogs running up to me that I've drawn on, barking and baying at me. I don't know what the hell is going on exactly that I seem to have all these encounters, but I do. So, you know, people are shaped by the things they encounter and run into in their experiences. So given my experiences, I see pepper spray as a very useful tool. And in cases where I hadn't had it, I would have gotten bit, no questions asked. And I think even in the prepper community or SHTF or, you know, off-grid type community, dogs are very much an under-analyzed threat. You know, a dog can give you a sucking chest wound in 10 seconds, you know, and if they can knock you down, you know, you got a real problem on your hands. And you know, not only to mention puncture wounds leading to infection and, you know, the threat of rabies transmission and stuff like that, but and pack mentality is also very dangerous. So that's some different things in my mind, some of the uses of pepper spray. And when I'm referring to pepper spray, what I love is the Fox 5.3. I'm not referring to your $10 squirt gun, you know, weak stream, not effective stuff. I get some of the best stuff that I can find or I've independently tested, at least law enforcement grade stuff. If I can get my hands on it, has always been my prerogative, so to speak. It's the best stuff that I use. Also, I'm a big fan of bear spray, and as far as bear spray goes, it's basically the same formulation as pepper spray. It's just a greater volume, and it usually has a longer range. Usually the bear spray, I've got shot that stuff out 20-30 feet, you know, so if you've got a threat, you can really put some distance between yourself and it, or stop it before it gets up on you, you know. And it's the same stuff as pepper spray, and there, depending on the state you're in, there's actually kind of a bit of a legal loophole, and that is on pepper sprays for self-defense, there's usually size restrictions on the canisters, usually about 4 ounces or so, at least in my state. But as far as bear spray goes and bear deterrent, there is no restriction on defense sprays designed for animals. So, I mean, I'm not a legal counsel, but it's a gray area. So it's something to think about, because, you know, bear spray, I keep a lot of it everywhere. I keep some in my vehicle. I keep some in my home for home defense. You know, I keep some in my bag when I go out into the woods, because you never know what you're going to encounter. And I think a lot of people that don't consider it as a viable option, it's because they haven't ever encountered a need for it. And it comes from a lack of knowing what's out there. You know, there's a lot of dangerous dogs out there, as well as people, and I've run into them myself. So it's something to consider. So anyway, well, and then on top of that, anytime I talk about this to people, a lot of the time it comes down to almost a philosophical purist type mentality. It's, you know, well, it's not the dogs, it's the owners, and, you know, there are no aggressive breeds, and, you know, all that's swell and good. But when you have a threat coming at you, it doesn't matter what part of that system broke down. You have a problem. You know, it doesn't matter if it was a failure of an owner. It doesn't matter if there's something wrong with the dog. All you got is a threat coming at you, and you need to neutralize that or deter it. You know, is what it comes down to. And when people throw that argument at me, you know, if you go to Walmart and you look around, the people around you, what people do you see look like they can take control of anything? You know, they can't, they don't have any control over their own lives. They have no self-discipline over their own lives or bodies. You're telling me you can put a big, powerful breed in their hands and they're going to be able to have control over that? You know, no, that's ridiculous, you know? And you need to analyze it more if you think that's the case. So anyway, so those are just some of my thoughts on pepper spray. I'd like to hear yours. I forgot to mention, also it's great for younger people, younger kids. You know, if you're sending them out into the woods or they're exploring or they're riding their bikes around the neighborhood or whatever, you know, they're either animal or people threats, you know, to a little kid. It can easily overpower it or kill a child in no time at all. Whereas, you know, you could have an 8-year-old boy or 8-year-old girl or fill in the blank. You give them a can of pepper spray, some good Fox .3, carry in your pocket. You know, if something runs up on you, whether it be a person or an animal, spray them with this, you know. And you might have just saved that child's life. So it's something that can be utilized by any age bracket in almost any environment. And it's got some great advantages. So anyway, that's just a couple of my my thoughts on it. And let me know what you think, Tim. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Joe. I think that was an excellent, excellent summary of the reason for a less than lethal application, and an excellent summary of why everybody needs to have that that option in their bag. Now, one last option that I want to talk about and share with you is an option that I'm enamored with, and that is blackjacks and saps, impact weapons. I love impact weapons. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about smacking the ever-loving crap out of some asshole that desperately deserves it that's just satisfying. Okay, it really is. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with a blackjack or a sap or a slapper, these used to be very common police weapons, and they were, before they had tasers and all of that, you know, a cop would carry a sap. And what it is, it's a leather, it's a piece of leather that's filled with lead powder or lead shot or something of that nature. And they can be a flat slapper, they can be a cylindrical blackjack. There's all different sizes and shapes and weights and styles and all of that. But basically, it's a piece of leather that's filled with some sort of weight that when you strike somebody with it, it delivers excruciating pain. And if you fill it with lead powder and you strike in the right area, it doesn't break any bones, and it's extremely effective. In fact, many police officers' uniforms back in the day used to have a special sap pocket. Pull it on the side of the thigh, on the side of the leg, and it was where, you know, you'd wear a low carry pistol, and so it was right there. You could pull it out, and when you struck somebody with it, you know, if you hit them in the head with it, it's like hitting them in the head with a hammer. It'll crack their skull, but you can hit them on the knee. You can hit them on the elbow, on the shoulder, you know, anywhere like that, on the thigh, on any large muscle group, and it's crippling as far as the pain. And so it can be used as a lethal weapon. It can be used as a non-lethal weapon. It can be used to break bones. It can be used to simply hurt large muscle groups, depending upon you know, how you use it and where you strike the person with and how hard. One of my favorite types of saps is what's known as a palm sap. And what a palm sap is, it's a piece of leather, strap of leather that has a lead weight in it. And this thing is worn around your palm so that the lead weight is in the palm of your hand. And the strap goes around below your fingers and above your thumb. So you just slide your hand into the strap, and what you do with it is you administer an open-handed slap. And the old-time Irish cops used to wear these palm saps. And from a distance, you can't see that they have anything in their hand because they're not carrying anything. But when you administer this open-handed slap, they were able to knock people out with one slap. And so they would go up to a street tough who was giving them some crap or talking back to them or what have you. And they would slap them upside the head with an open-handed slap, and they would knock them out. And that would tend to shut the other ones up. And in today's society, when everything you do is recorded with surveillance cameras, you have cameras everywhere. You go to the gas station. Every step you take from exiting your vehicle all the way in is recorded. You go to any shopping mall, it's all recorded. You walk up and down the street in a city, it's all recorded. You are on camera everywhere you go. But these cameras usually are not high def enough to spot whether or not you would be wearing a palm sap. And so if you were involved in a dispute or you were threatened or something like that and the threat didn't rise to the level of lethal force, if you administered an open hand slap to somebody and you were wearing a palm sap, you'd knock the ever-loving shit out of them. And then when the videotape is played, when the surveillance tape is played, you slapped them. So yes, you did make contact with them, but there was no deadly weapon involved. And to me, this is a critical point. A good example, and this is just the low quality of the human animal that exists in the former United States of America these days. Recently, I was on the interstate traveling. I pulled off the interstate to get gas and use the restroom. And when I pulled up to the parking lot, right in front of the convenience store, got out of my truck, there was a guy standing there, and he was your typical meth head looking low life. He had the neck tats. You know, everybody's got to have a neck tattoo on them. And they're wearing the short pants that come down below the knees, you know, the long short pants. And you could just look at the guy and you could tell you're dealing with a low life son of a bitch. Okay. And yeah, I judge people. I'm very judgmental and I don't apologize for it. That's what we do. We that's called situational awareness. And of course he's got his female companion there, who's morbidly obese, covered in tattoos as well. And they're just sort of hanging out in front of the convenience store because, hey, that's what productive people do. That's what people that have jobs, people that produce, people that pay taxes, this is what they do, is they hang out in front of the convenience store, right? So I exit my truck, lock the door, close it. He walks up and he says, "What'd you lock the door for?" And I look him dead in the eye. I've got my hand in my pocket. And I make the decision. I'll kill this guy right here if he fucks with me. Now, a lot of you may think that's extreme. But he could sense that. And he backed up. I never altered my gait. I didn't step aside. I walked straight past him, brushed up against him, and kept walking. I never said a word to him. I never acknowledged him other than looking into his eyes. And he could tell I wasn't going to put up with his shit. Now, you can't just pull out a pistol and kill a guy. What if he had put his hand on my chest? What if he had stepped in front of me? You going to pull a pistol out and shoot him when they play the tape? You're going to prison. But if he puts his hand on me and then I slap him, well, that's a different matter. And what was interesting is as I exited the store, he was still perched in his spot where he was accosting people. And there was another guy that pulled up in a very nice truck. He was from up north. You could tell. I looked. You could see the tag, and I'm not going to mention the state. But as he got out, the guy did the same thing. Walked up to him. What'd you lock the door for? And this guy was completely different. He was caught completely off guard. And he starts engaging the man in conversation. Like, what? What are you talking about here? And so you see, the scumbag had gained ascendancy. He had taken control of the situation. He was in command. He had somebody he could game, he could scam, that he could control. This type of situation happens every single day. You encounter these low-life vermin everywhere you go. Now, in a proper world, you could handle this situation properly. But we don't live in a proper world anymore, do we? So these are the kind of things that you need to think about. Because as society continues to disintegrate, this is going to become more common. It's going to become more physical. It's going to become more in your face. And you have to decide how you're going to respond to those types of situations. But when I encounter these people, I don't even consider them to be human. I make that decision up front, and that governs every action that I take from then on out. They mean nothing to me. Nothing. I have no problem slapping that son of a bitch to the ground, stepping right on his face, and keeping right on walking. Because let me tell you something. They'd treat you a hell of a lot worse if they ever get the upper hand on you. And what the liberal hand-wringer would call judgmental, I call being situationally aware. So anyway, give it some thought. And by the time this goes live, I will be in a much more relaxed state. I will be deep in the Sipsey River Wilderness again. I will be hiking down Quillen Creek Canyon down to Hubbard Creek Canyon, which is some of the wildest, most untamed, most beautiful terrain I've ever seen. And it's what this country used to look like before we decided to improve it with asphalt and concrete. So anyway, hope this was worth your time. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you next time.
In March of 2009, I was hired by a California-based company to travel to the Perrottsville, Tennessee home of renowned and notorious moonshiner Marvin Popcorn Sutton. The ATF had arrested Popcorn after a raid on his property that yielded some 850 gallons of moonshine. He was convicted on federal charges in late 2008, and he was scheduled to start serving his sentence in federal prison the Friday after our portrait session. He never reported to prison. On March 16, 2009, the day after our session, Popcorn Sutton took his own life. To say I was shocked at the news would be an understatement. It took me several days just to process the information. These images are among the very last images of moonshining legend Marvin Popcorn Sutton, who died March 16, 2009. May he rest in peace. Popcorn Sutton was best known for his appearances in documentaries on the History Channel and his book, Me and My Liquor. You may have seen him recently on the series Moonshiners on the Discovery Channel. But the people of East Tennessee and Western North Carolina knew him for his moonshine. For many years, it was considered the best shine you could buy, and you were lucky if you get your hands on some. The California-based company that hired me was in the process of brewing Popcorn Shine legally, and they needed marketing images of the master before he reported to prison. When I arrived at the property, I was invited in by Popcorn's wife. Popcorn looked frail and weak. He was lying on a sofa wrapped in a blanket. I was told that he'd been ill, which in the South usually means that you're dying of something, or could die of something, or you just have a cold. It wasn't clear, but Popcorn didn't look well. He sat up slowly, got his feet on the floor, and screamed something almost unintelligible. It was loud, it was crass, and it was a question. And I'm not going to repeat it here, but suffice to say, it was something about what I like to eat. I was born and raised in the South. I knew this was a test. A test to see how I'd react to his crassness and the question. Without skipping a beat, I replied, "Damn right I do." "Well, good," Popcorn said, "because if you didn't, I'd say you was a no-good son of a bitch." From there, we hit it off fine, and Popcorn gave me 2.5 hours of the last full day of his life. He showed me around his property, old run-down cars, shacks, outhouses, and tools of every shape, form, and fashion. He tried to sell me everything and anything I laid eyes on, and all the while I continued to capture image after image of this old man in his world. Popcorn was quick to ask what I thought was poked through the front of his signature hat. I thought it was a bone of some kind, but Popcorn laughed and said, "No, it's a dried raccoon pecker." At first glance, it looked like a cheap digital watch, but it wasn't. It was the electronic monitor the feds used to keep Popcorn under house arrest. While Popcorn waited to go to federal prison, he was under house arrest, and he was only allowed to leave his property once a week on Mondays to visit his doctor. Our session was on a Sunday, March 15th. On Monday, March 16th, Popcorn got into his car as he would any other Monday, as if he was going to the doctor's office. Instead of the doctor's office, he drove to a remote part of his property, and as I was told, he ran a garden hose from the exhaust to the window of his car. He was found dead in his car late that afternoon. Since I first published these images, I've been asked many times if Popcorn seemed resigned or morose. I don't know if he was resigned or even morose, but he didn't seem tired, almost exhausted, and often his bright blue eyes were lost somewhere in the distance. I assume they were focused on the task that he knew lay ahead. Popcorn Sutton was a man who did things his way, including ending his own life. I'm just grateful that he chose to give me 2.5 hours at the end. Rest in peace, Popcorn.